This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress and the studios of the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're with Barbara Quick, who's a poet and a novelist, and she's going to start with a poem.
This poem is called Crow's Feet. Great-grandmother came to me in a dream, fluttered at my windowsill, in her hands a needle and thread. "Don't believe what they tell you about angels, my child," she whispered in Russian. Only then I noticed her wings, glossy black against the lace curtains. Her feet were tiny and pale, cloud-like. She said, "I am the weight of your mother and your mother's mother. I am the tongue grown heavy with silence." She planted one foot each upon my eyes. I slept, the smell of feathers in my nostrils, and today I see crow's feet at the corners of my eyes, a breath of the shtetl over the bed, and black feathers everywhere.
This is the way I love to start the day. Barbara Quick, you never disappoint me. What book is that from?
Well, this has not been published in a book yet. It was published a million years ago in, I think it was the Kansas Quarterly. And I don't have a full-length collection published yet, so it's circulating around.
Oh,
I'm waiting.
So we're getting premieres today.
Absolutely.
Well, then somebody's better hear you and say, "I want that."
I
big
hope
time.
So.
How many poems are in this new manuscript?
It's about, the usual length, like 48 pages, something like that.
But you've written hundreds more.
I've written lots and lots of poetry, but I've really curated this to, it's called Tikkun Olam.
That's the title?
Yes, and which is about healing the world, and the subtitle is A Life in Poems, and that's what it really is, because this poem that I just read, I wrote so many years ago. I was in my 20s, and now I am 70, so
oh my goodness, this is going to be your biography. Well, I'd like to say that you have four novels that have had, I must say, a great acclaim. I've read them, and a fifth one is on its way. So, are you a novelist?
Well, I am a novelist.
But you're thought of as a poet.
I am a poet. I'm a poet and a novelist. And the wonderful thing for me, Grace, is just in these last couple of years, the two have merged in me. So, you know, it's the integrated Gemini, maybe. But now I feel that my poetry infuses my fiction, and my fiction is infused with poetry. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, you are one of the world's most lyrical prose writer. So I get it. I get that that's in your DNA. So you have four books, and give us some context for the book that is from Poetry, the Blue Light Poetry Press Book Award. And the title of that book was what?
The Light on Sifnos. It's a chapbook of poems that I wrote during a three-week stay on the Aegean island of Sifnos in Greece. And it was an absolutely haunted island, and I probably wrote, sometimes I wrote two poems a day there. It was just, there were words in the air floating in the ether around me, and they came to me in dreams, and they came to me right through my hand to my notebook.
And that won the award.
Yes.
And give us the title again.
The Light on Sifnos, and it's from Blue Light Press.
And that's available.
Absolutely. Cool. Yeah, you can get it on Amazon.
Well, let's go ahead and get it, everybody.
Well, that's
nice. Well, let's hear two poems together so that we get to know Barbara Quick, who has come from Connecticut on a wintry day to tell us who she is by what she writes.
This next poem is a very recent poem, unlike the last one, and it's called Spirits Are Attracted by the Smell of Yeast. Just before bed, I stir the yeast to life in the blue earthenware bowl I have used these many years to make bread. Even before the mixture begins to bubble, I sense Nana's spirit nearby, murmuring praise for my kitchen skills as she always did so generously when alive. And while the dough rises overnight, covered with a cloth like the head of a pious Jew in prayer, the smell of living yeast fills the air. And the spirit of my oldest best friend's husband visits me in a dream, reaches out a hand, and I can see that he is whole and healthy again in his life between lives, vital, happy, and healed. The dough feels alive when I shape it the next afternoon into two round loaves, cupping each one in my hands, smoothing the seams downward where they won't show, shaping each loaf as tenderly as I held my newborn son 31 years ago.
And another.
This poem is called What the Trees Are Saying. Let them all go, every last one of these desiccated leaves that still cling to us. Let them find the courage to let the wind launch them on their first and last solo dance across the sunlit stage of air. Pirouette and grand jeté, fluttering, joining the gypsy skirts that swirl around each mother tree. Let them make way for the swelling buds beneath the bark that masquerades as something dead. Let go. Let go.
What do you think this book is about?
Well, there is actually a chapbook that's coming out in fall from Blue Moose Press. I just found out about that. I'm very excited about it.
With some of these poems?
Yes, including that one that I just read.
What do you think you're saying?
It's about being part of nature. I mean, I am part of nature, and that's where I find my poems, and that's where the poems find me, and that's my place.
The interesting thing about you is that you are actually a world-class chef and gardener, and this comes up in your poetry because you're not just someone in an ivory tower. You're out there with your hands in the dirt, and then you're in the kitchen. You've washed your hands first, of course, and you're known for this, and it's in your writing because you have substacks, you have prose, you have essays, you have other things besides poetry and novels. And so I think it's so interesting that when we finish a book of yours, we have the portrait of a person who is beyond being a poet. But I'm really also interested in the novels. How I was with you when you began writing a novel, and I'll never get over watching the first five pages come out of your room at a writer's retreat. I mean, if there's magic, you've got it. So I'm just going to name these novels. And it's, well, let me see, Vivaldi's Virgins, Northern Edge, A Golden Web, What Disappears, and now Something Is in the Oven that's going to be forthcoming. How do you write a novel?
I've got to say, it probably sounds very mystical, but I think I am, I do come out of mysticism, and in the same way that nature does. I mean, it's just, it's in the ether. It's something, it's there. I don't set out to say, oh, I'm going to write a novel, but instead I'm completely obsessed by something. A voice comes to me. Often it comes to me in a dream. Often it comes to me when I just wake up, the voice is in my head. And I just start writing the first phrase. I write it down. And the rest just comes.
It's unbelievable. If they don't institutionalize us, we get a good novel out of this. But it is true that characters do come and occupy your space. But I saw this with my eyes. We were at a writer's retreat, and you had been obsessing and incubating this idea and talking about it. And the idea had been with you for years.
Yes.
And then you were gone before lunch, and you came back with five pages. And I don't think you ever had to correct those five pages.
What's very funny about that is that's the only writer's retreat I've ever gone to in my life, Grace. But it was so productive because that's where I met you. And we started our journey.
I know, but we have to have one anecdote. We can edit it out if you don't like it. But Toad Hall was a fabulous writer's retreat in New Hampshire, and we had just read Vivaldi's Virgins, which was by Barbara. All of us, the poets in Washington, Vivaldi's Virgins, it went around like hotcakes. So we said, oh my gosh, who is this woman? I've never read a book like this in my life. So let's invite her to the retreat. Never thinking we would get you. Now, she did not know us. We could have been serial murderers. We could have been human traffickers. At 2 o'clock in the morning, a taxi comes up, and here is this petite little novelist with a suitcase, and she says, I'm Barbara Quick. And that is how we met. So here's a woman who's not afraid of the world, and give us two more poems.
Okay, I will. Okay, this poem is called The Bees and I. This comes out of the time very recently when I was living in Sonoma County on a vineyard, and we had an outdoor shower. The bees and I share a place on the patio where a flurry of peppermint all in bloom brushes my knees when I shower. Each tiny, pale lavender flower is an offering to these agricultural workers who gather the pollen and bring it home to their queen. I soap up gingerly, as attentive to the bees as they are, I hope, oblivious of me. One false move might result in pain on some vulnerable part of my body, and death for the bee, unlucky enough to believe that I meant to harm him. We're both drones, he and I, doing our best to survive the work we're called to do, both of us gathering as much of the sweetest stuff as we can before we're through.
I love those interior rhymes and the end rhymes. Keep going.
Thank you. And I should say, I'm not only not in an ivory tower, I have no advanced degree, and I've never studied writing in school.
And you insisted on not studying it in college.
That's right.
Such a rebel. Let's hear another poem.
I've always been. This is called 1,000 Paper Airplanes. If I could fold 1,000 paper airplanes from the pages of poetry and prose stacked one-sided in the recycling box beneath my desk, if when I launched them from a high place, bright white against the blue sky, they could, as in an animated film or fever dream, turn into birds. If those messengers, freighted with my words, could fly to lands where readers wait with cupped hands ready to hold each feathered arc, to feel the warm, fluttering heart encased inside. If all that I am and all that I've written could come to rest in soil that feeds a family of redwoods. If forest mushrooms could weave a silver cocoon of life over what remains of me, if in my transformation I could give my skin, my flesh, my bones, and all my printed words back to the trees.
I am going to give my workshop that prompt to start a stanza with if, because if is a feeling state where everything's possible, right?
Yes.
It is a subjunctive. It's a state of being where anything can happen after if. And that must have made it easier for you to fulfill your wishes there in each stanza.
Well,
if is like a little hydraulic.
Yes. Well, this is one of those poems that just arrived, and, you know, and as a little gift, and I felt so grateful. I always feel, after I'm able to write a poem, it feels like a miracle. And when I haven't written in a while, I feel, oh, no, I'll never write another poem again. Never.
Everyone feels that way. Maya Angelou said when she looked at the blank page, she thought, how do I start? How do I start? But what is your discipline? Do you wake in the morning and write a poem? Do you meditate? Do you have a certain time of day?
I wake in the morning, and my dear husband brings me a hot cup of tea and knows not to talk to me at all. I have my tea, I have my notebook. And a handsome husband, and I just wake up and open the notebook. I put down the date, and I wait. I just get really, really quiet because the words are out there. I think the collective imagination is something available to all of us. I think I'm just particularly porous as a person. Honestly, I think so. I don't think I have as many barriers as people usually have, as many filters. It just comes in, and I receive it gratefully.
I'm glad you said that, because I truly believe the consciousness is above us, and we just pull it through us.
Yes, and it connects us. It connects everyone who's creative, who's working in a creative field. It's all the same beautiful thing that we're creating and recreating.
It's all the same beautiful thing. So then now we talk about some beautiful things that are novels. And first of all, before we'll go back to poetry, but you know, Camus says we're always telling the same story again and again. What is the story in your novels you're always telling?
That's a good question, because there is one story I'm telling over and over again. And I was not an orphan. I'm not an orphan, but I grew up with an emotional scenario of being an orphan. So in all my novels, there's a search for that long-lost person who should have loved you and didn't, wasn't there for you. And so my life has been a search for that essential love that gives me the permission to exist and keep existing and feel good about it.
So, and out of that, you have woven tapestries of lyricism, scenes, sensuality, characters, situations, plots. Imagine what you've done with that. And that's a really good answer. So in your novels, there's always a young woman protagonist, and there's something to overcome. And so I would like you, this is kind of a little test, to name each of your novel titles and then just one sentence about a person who is doing what in that novel. Let's start with Northern Edge.
Okay. Tay McElroy, who's feels like a rather ordinary person working as an assistant at the campus in Berkeley, is invited to go with a group of field biologists to Arctic Alaska, to a completely unknown environment. And there she must discover her strength, her ability to survive, and her perception that the world is an amazing and beautiful place.
Whoa. Okay, the next one we're going to hear about is Vivaldi's Virgins.
Vivaldi's Virgins is that I heard from somebody that there was a foundling home in Venice in the 18th century where Antonio Vivaldi was the resident priest and music master. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to write a novel about one of those musicians. So I made one up, and I called her Pellegrina, and then I did research there in the archives, and I found that there was another, a real person named Anna Maria, who exactly fit my description of Pellegrina. And so I wrote about this foundling in this place where her parentage was kept completely secret, and her desperate search to find out who her parents were, because her life and livelihood depended on that knowledge.
Why did Vivaldi have a house full of virgins?
Well, it wasn't Vivaldi's house. He was just a struggling musician. I mean, he was a wonderful
violinist
and composer.
Why did these women stay there to be trained?
Well, it was an institution that the state provided for children who didn't have parents who could take care of them. So it was actually a benevolent institution. There were four of these ospedali in Venice and in other Italian cities of the time. And they were given food and clothing.
But they must learn the violin.
No, only the talented ones. Only the ones who were deemed talented enough could learn to, were taught music and to play. And they were a supremely gifted orchestra and choir heard by the crowned heads of Europe. And their concerts provided the revenue for the institution to keep all the other children fed and clothed and given medical
care. But you
had
one hero who needed something, and we always have to have someone who needs and wants something in a book. How about A Golden Web?
A Golden Web is about a girl who may or may not have existed. I haven't been able to prove it yet, but there's lots of information about her in Bologna. Her name was Alessandra Giuliani. She was the daughter of a stationer, someone who created books. It's the 14th century, very early on. So there's little physical evidence left that would point to her life. But she is someone whose mother died in childbirth, and she desperately wanted to find the cure for what killed her mother in childbirth, to become a physician and a researcher. And in that time, women, girls would be burned at the stake as a witch if they studied anatomy, if they tried to go to medical school. So she cross-dressed with her maid. They cross-dressed and they went riding off to the University of Bologna Medical School. And she made a wonderful discovery, about the circulatory system and the heart. And
What year did you write that novel?
That was in 2010 that it was published.
Because I remember you talking about someone, the idea at one point, the idea of this woman, this little girl who is dressing as a boy, before the novel was written. So I know that you have little pressure cookers inside of you that are always working and incubating and thinking of these things years before they come to pass. Well, what is this new book, What Disappears? And I have to say that your knowledge of Europe is really astounding.
Well, I'm a very assiduous researcher, but thank you. I do delve very deeply. I read widely and go into all the archives I can find. And in the case of What Disappears, which is a novel about the world of the Ballet Russe in Belle Epoque, Paris, I watched a lot of film, film clippings, whatever I could find. I looked at a lot of photo archives and read a lot of first-person memoirs.
And it doesn't hurt that you know French, and I think Italian. French, I know you're fluent in, and Italian, pretty darn good. So that shows up in your writing.
No, I love learning languages, and it always helps. It always
And I think a little
writing.
Russian got in there.
Well, German, some German.
Imagine, well, just while you're cooking and gardening.
Actually, literally, that's true, Grace, because I listen to language lessons while I'm baking, cooking, gardening. I'm a great or terrible multitasker. I'm always multitasking. I love talking on the phone to people I love, but when I'm just doing something that requires my hands, I practice Italian, I practice German, I practice French, even Chinese a little bit. So it's great fun.
I know it's true because I've seen it happen. And so what disappears?
So the What Disappears is about two identical twins who were born in Tsarist Russia to a Jewish family. Because they're in terrible financial straits, the family, they have to put them in an orphanage, they hope temporarily, and they're separated. One is adopted by a family in France and raised as an anti-Semitic Catholic. So the story is about these two disparate parts of a whole coming together. It's also about being careful what you wish for. It's about dance. I love dance, too. I mean, it's really part of my DNA, even though I was never a professional dancer.
I saw you do the Brazilian thing.
But,
tell us about the ballet.
Oh, yes.
That's at the heart of the book.
Yes. It's about striving for anything that's very, very hard. It's about how hard you need to work to achieve anything substantial. You really need to work. And ballet is a wonderful metaphor for that, because it's your whole body. You're in pain so often. You risk everything. You hurt everything. It's over very early in your life. And yet, if you can do it, it's transformative. Mm. It's celestial. It's like writing a poem. It's like writing a novel.
It is a metaphor for being a disciple to something. And this book, although you just described the veneer of it, is full of action, adventure, pathos, sex, fashion, the fashion industry,
yes.
The ballet. Backstage, we get to meet great ballet characters. And How long did that take you?
Well, you know, I could say it took me 40 years, Grace, because I started this novel the same year that I wrote that first poem I read about crow's feet, about my great grandmother in Russia, because it's the same material.
I see you're holding in your hand a book, What Disappears, and what is on the cover?
The cover shows the Eiffel Tower and a couple of little ballet dancers.
And what I wanted to mention is that this is intergenerational, this book.
Yes.
So it not only carries people through a life and a next life, but it's on different continents as well. So you had a lot you were juggling. And if you will set up a tiny reading for us to get a taste of it and give us the background of what you're going to read.
Well, this is easy. It doesn't need much background because this is the first page of the book. Paris, 1909. Backstage is where the magic meets the real world. Ballerinas in toe shoes and white tulle waft like blossoms detached by the wind, swirling past the gears and pulleys of stagecraft, seeming to float rather than scurry up metal stairs, past outsized props and sets and stagehands who pause in their work to watch them, always in love with one or another of the dancers. The smell of scent, cigarettes and chalk, and someone's coke au vin in a metal pail. Behind a door marked by a star, Anna Pavlova looks into the mirror and then, sighing, closes her eyes. Breathe, she tells herself. She can't afford to lose another maid, not now, and her seamstress has never let her down before. She has high expectations for her pas de deux with that young savage Nijinsky. She's never seen another boy with such strength and elevation, combined with a sort of madness that makes him disappear into whatever role he's playing. She'd been nervous about that huge sapphire ring he wore to their run-through that morning. He'd made a point of showing it off, telling her it had been a gift from Sergei himself. Sure enough, while Nijinsky held and turned her in a backbend high above his head, while she danced midair, the ring snagged the fabric of her costume and ripped it open all along the left side of the bodice. A disaster with only an hour left before their call. Zlata, you cow! The sylph-like dancer screams out her dressing room door. Where is Sonia? Zlata returns, red-faced and puffing, holding by the arm one of the extra ballerinas who is just arriving to get into costume.
Now, I want to talk about lyrics. I could count the metrics in those lines. Behind a door marked by a star. Da, 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 da.
That's funny. I never noticed that before.
You see, there is so much poetry in your work, and the prose is really lyricism, and that is why their books are popular. I don't even know if people know why they like that. They may not see that, but it is seamless. It is metrical because you think that way.
I guess that's how it arrives in my particular brain.
Are you musical?
Yes.
Oh.
I don't play an instrument, but my husband, who's a professional musician, assures me that I have a lot of musical talent. So I do wish that is my one regret. I don't regret anything that I studied and worked at in my life, but I do regret the things that I did not work at.
Well, I regret that you're not cloned because that would have solved our problem. Just one person in one lifetime. I want to talk a little bit about how you proceeded then. So you got the jump off place in the novel, and then did you get to an arid place where you thought, what's going to happen next? Do you seem to know what's going to happen throughout the book, or do you discover it every day?
Well, I wrote a very short version of the book when I was in my early 20s. I called it The Russian Winter. It all took place in Tsarist Russia. And it did not involve these twins. It was based on my grandmother's family in Russia and the stories that she told me, and I wove them into a scene that was very vivid for me, including the she was in love with the pharmacist's son, the pharmacist named Yasha.
And the pharmacist is in here.
He is, Yasha. But my grandmother always talked, you know, this old lady talking about, oh, Yasha's kiss, I still think of it. And she said this in front of my grandfather. We were always a little
Yasha's
embarrassed.
Yasha's kiss.
Yasha's kiss. But Yasha's kiss lived on and became a very important plot point in this novel. And then I discovered, I made the connection with the Ballet Russe, with dancing, and both these twins wind up working for the Ballet Russe, unbeknownst to one another. One is an extra dancer, one is a seamstress, carrying on her mother's work from Russia.
And it's historically accurate.
Yes, well, the fictional characters are purely fictional, but all the history.
But the ballet and the characters.
Oh, yes. Well, what a rich time that was. I mean, it was the great period of artistic foment in Europe. Everyone was there, all the painters, all the musicians. It was what's called the Belle Époque. So, you know, it's in the 19-teens up until the beginning of World War I, which is where my novel ends. You know, it's they're on the cusp of this great change, and that's why it's called What Disappears.
Oh.
And this is a time that I think we can identify with now. We're seeing a lot of what we thought would always be here. We see it disappearing before our eyes, and it's heartbreaking. It's hard. It's ripping our hearts out.
But something remains. I'm looking at it. Something remains. And that is what art does. It, first of all, wakes us up from our dream, just from our plastic dream. And then Buddha says, may you be awake one moment before you die. Mm. And then this will live longer than you will.
That's a wonderful thought.
Yes. And we will hear a little bit more about it. I just want people to know clearly what the book is called, where they can get it.
It's called What Disappears, and it was published by Regal House.
And it's a pretty book.
It's a pretty book. It's a beautiful, beautiful book.
And the author is
Barbara Quick. I'm the author. And you can get it at Regal House. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on bookshop.org. You can ask your favorite bookstore to order it for you.
And while this is still hot and it's just still breathing, you have another book started or finished?
I have actually two other novels finished and ready to go. And I've started a new novel. I woke up with the first line in the title, which I'm not going to say, just the other morning. And I wrote down the first lines of the book.
That's because you have a husband who brings you hot tea.
I think so.
Wait a minute, though. There is a book in the works, not just beginning. There is a another book.
Oh, yeah, The Stolen Child.
Yes. Is that being published?
I don't have a publisher yet. I have a wonderful agent.
Is it finished?
It's finished.
And
oh,
what
yes.
is, give us one sentence about that.
It's a modern retelling of the Persephone myth. It's about a Berkeley therapist whose daughter suddenly dies. And in her grief, the mother tries to find a way to redeem something, someone, because she just wants to die. And she ends up using her dead daughter's passport to rescue a child of the same age out of Ceausescu's Romania right before the changeover to a multi-party democracy. So that also has great relevance now because it's people struggling against despotism. It's people struggling for freedom and democracy.
And so how much did you know about that part of the world when you started this work?
Well, I started it when I was actually living in Budapest. I lived there for 9 months with my then husband, and we were taking a lot of notes, and we were sort of adopted by the dissident political underground. So I learned a lot, and it was all there.
Well, I'll tell you, you haven't wasted much of your lifetime. So read us a bit more of What Disappears.
With pleasure.
And set it up for us.
Thank you, Grace. So this is one of the twins, Sonia, the Russian one, who's the seamstress, and she's still in Russia. She's in the midst of the terrible pogrom of 1903.
Tell people what that means.
It means that after living peacefully, fairly peacefully, for years at a time in this Russian city. The Tsar decided that, oh, the Jews are the enemies, and we're just going to kill them. We're going to go out and destroy their businesses. We're going to hurt their children. We're going to try to throw them out of the country. We're going to, you know, it was just this arbitrary, horrendous decision, and lots of people suffered. People are still suffering from that. So this is one of the things that happened when a group was basically expelled by the country for what it was, what it tried to be. They were told they were unwanted.
So that is historical. That's the backdrop. And this is the fiction.
Yes. So Sonia has her two very young children, and she's been sheltering with them in the attic of the church, and she's come out to this scene of horrific wreckage in Kishinev, in her home. Never in her entire life had she felt such despair and such a sense of self-loathing. The little bell above the door was hanging at an angle like a songbird caught in some netting and left to die. The morning sun shone through the gaping windows, but Sonia was shivering so hard that her teeth chattered. Everything was in ruin. The mirrors smashed, the furniture ravaged as if attacked by wolves. Every time she pressed her hands against her eyes, trying to staunch the flood of tears, she would see Asher's winsome smile and the way he'd so often looked at her, his eyes filled with gratitude and love. She hadn't deserved him. He wouldn't have loved her if he'd seen who she really was. What would become of her and her daughters and this baby growing inside her? Where could they turn? Her sewing machine, dented and cudgeled. The sewing machines were sunken into their cabinets, separated from their treadles. Unwound spools of thread and bobbins, multicolored tangles of bias tape, and crumpled pieces of pattern paper were scattered everywhere. Who were these people? These neighbors and merchants, these men she'd wished good day, who tipped their cap to her and tousled Olga's curls? Who were these monsters who had murdered her husband and left her children without a father, destroyed their shop, leaving Sonia and her children without a home? The glass in the frames that held their family photographs was shattered. The photographs had been ripped into pieces along with all the leather-bound books that had filled their shelves, Asher's books. What could cause people, the normal, everyday people of Kishinev, to suddenly turn so hateful? What had she and Asher ever done to offend them? Hadn't she always been a good neighbor and friend? Wasn't her shop always a lovely, welcoming place where Jews and Christians alike drank glasses of tea while Sonia confected beautiful clothing and hats for them? Hadn't the mayor's wife, delighted with her new cloak, kissed Sonia's cheeks and told her that she was one of Kishinev's treasures? She bent down and picked up a pair of Asher's glasses crushed by someone's boot. Close to her ear, she heard Olga murmur, "Papa."
Wow. Not only do we have plot and situation, but it's the sensuality, the detail, the thread, the bobbin separated, the machines, the treadle, the visuals. I think that if anyone is studying to be a writer, they would listen closely to that, because it is, we have to see, smell, and touch, right? Everything you write, we can actually taste, see, smell, or in some way, it is so sensual. And I guess that's the difference between a seasoned writer and a beginning writer. Finally, before we have a closing poem, I just want to say, as I was thinking, as I listened to you and see all the forthcoming books burgeoning in your mind, how literature is the difference between a civilization and a society. And you can thank yourself for that contribution. because our civilization would be just like people, mannequins walking in the mud without literature.
Well, I'm writing a Substack these days called Lifeboat, made of words, and this words are my lifeboat. They have saved my life every single day of this life,
if
and they continue to.
Want to get that? How can they get that on their computer?
Oh, just go to the Substack app and search for Lifeboat Made of Words
by Barbara Quick.
Yes, okay. Yes, it's there.
And we want to hear a final poem.
Okay, thank you, Grace. This is called A Californian with a Complicated History Bakes Bread in Connecticut. My hands were schooled in the music of baking bread long before they knew the secrets of human flesh. A virgin on the threshold of the many lives I'd choose and then reject. I watched my best friend's mother, much revered and slightly witchy, conjure fresh-baked loaves from flour, yeast and water, thyme and heat. Nothing like this happened in the house where I was raised, the house I knew I needed to escape. I lift each mound of living dough in upturned hands, caress the seams to shape a loaf that's silky and round. When at the age of 38, I held my newborn son just so, my hands recognized the sensation from so long ago when I first started baking. In this latest incarnation of my kitchen, this latest version of my life as writer and wife, the flour I've sprinkled on the marble counter sings softly of the shimmering fields of wheat far away where it was raised. My hands know how to do their work by heart, and I can dream while I knead and turn the dough, recall myself in all my ages through 50-some-odd years or so of baking. Each loaf I've made, tied to every other, and tied to me by silk satin ribbons woven from memories of feeding the changing caste of those I've loved. And I am always older than I was yesterday, hurtling toward the end of my lifespan, like time-lapse photography, in each image my aging hands shaping the living mixture of flour and salt, honey and yeast, practicing the art and craft of transformation.
Each loaf I've has tied to each other and to me. Yes. What is that line? Each loaf has tied one to the other and tied to me.
Every time I bake bread, which is approximately once a week, I look at my hands and I realize I feel the sense of wholeness with my life because I feel like I've lived so many different lives in a way with all these different novels and all these different places where I've lived and traveled and written. But baking bread is something that I've done throughout this time and it grounds me.
And the word transformation is a perfect word for you. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios of the Library of Congress with Barbara Quick. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding was provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, the Sinibit Fund, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.